Hello, and welcome to the Ace Pod episode 1.12, brought to you by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. I apologize in advance for my voice. I'm dealing with some allergies. So if I get a little rough in here, blame the great outdoors. Got a lot coming for you in this episode, as usual. Got a big old mailbag ready to roll, focusing a lot on hoops, especially in the wake of the Franz Wagner injury news. If you missed it, he is reportedly going to miss anywhere between 4 to 6 weeks with an injury that thankfully will not require surgery, but still could potentially keep him out for a very healthy chunk of Michigan's non-conference schedule. Later in the show, we'll also have Nick Baumgartner to help get this MGO blog partnership with The Athletic going, talking to him about football and big picture stuff, I would guess, in large part. Excited to get that going. It's nice to not just be talking to myself this episode. That said, I will continue talking to myself for the rest of this segment. We're going to start off with your basketball questions. This one from Andrew Baden on Twitter. Who could potentially benefit most from Franz being out with injury, and how much, if at all, should we temper our expectations for non-conference? So a ton of this depends on when Wagner is actually able to return, because he may, you know, if he gets back on the quick side of his 4 to 6 week window, he may just miss basically a bunch of tune-up games. However, if he gets more towards the 6 week end of that, then he is missing the Battle for Atlantis tournament, which should contain most of Michigan's quality non-conference games. He'll already definitely be missing Creighton, which is a top 40 KenPom opponent. Speaking of which, we'll be talking more about KenPom's newly released rankings later on. And if you get to the back end of his injury window, if it extends really anywhere beyond that 6 weeks, he's in danger of missing the critical Louisville game. And they are third in the early KenPom projections. That is easily projected to be Michigan's toughest non-conference opponent, barring a potentially a deep run and slamming into Gonzaga in the battle for Atlantis. And then Michigan has two Big Ten games, Iowa and Illinois, neither of which are gimmies right after that. So it certainly changes Michigan's outlook, not just because Wagner could miss these games, but because he's not getting the chance to kind of find his footing against the Elons and Houston Baptists of the world before getting thrown in. He, you know, in all likelihood, if he comes back for the Battle of Atlantis, pretty much no matter where he comes back during this injury window, he's going to be facing off against power conference competition. So he's going to get high majors right off the bat. He's going to have to kind of find his role on this team. I suspect he'll have to start as coming off the bench, just based on that circumstance, and it might take a little bit longer for this team to gel. So, well, thankfully the tournament committee will take this into account. I do think you got to dial down expectations a little bit for Michigan. For as long as Wagner's out, and maybe for a week or two after he returns, where some of those more toss-up games, you know, the game against Creighton at home, the Iowa State game to start the Battle for Atlantis, those are, you know, Iowa to open the Big Ten. Those are looking more like pure toss-ups than maybe games where you lean for Michigan to win. As for who can potentially step up and fill and benefit from Wagner being out. There are certainly a number of options. The problem is that none of them are particularly proven. I think this locks Eli Brooks into the starting lineup pretty much, barring potentially breakouts from both at this point, Cole Bajema and Adrian Nunez, since Brandon Johns is also working through a bit of an ankle injury, although it sounds relatively minor, and hopefully he will be back for the opener. They have not given a timetable for that. This really this spreads Michigan thin because Wagner, it sounds like the way they were talking at Media Day, they were maybe even planning to have him be the sixth man to begin the season because of his ability to fill in at the two through four positions. And now Michigan is relatively thin at those spots. It's going to be very hard for Isaiah Livers to slide down to the three right now, especially with Brandon. If Brandon Johns misses any length of time, it potentially spreads Colin Castleton thin if he has to back up both the four and five positions. You can probably get away with Austin Davis backing up at center against the kind of cannon fodder on the schedule, but I don't know if you want him to be in that position once you get to Atlantis. And then you're looking at guys. I mean, you're at this point really hoping that Brandon Johns is ready to play, and ready to play a lot, so that Livers can shift around the lineup a little bit more. And you're hoping for a jump from Brooks to the point where, yes, he's probably going to be a solid defender, but can he be a viable offensive threat, especially from beyond the arc? Because Michigan is short on shooters right now, and that's one thing that they expected Wagner to really bring. And then, I mean, now you really got to bank on either Nunez or Bajema being a guy who can at least come off the bench and knock down some three pointers. Because otherwise, this team, while Wagner's out, is going to lean extremely hard on the core of Simpson, Teske, and Livers, and pretty much everything else is an unknown. So, part of this is your guess being as good as mine. There are certainly several players that could potentially benefit, and there is, if you're looking for silver linings, there is at least now a very big opening for Bajema and Nunez to work their way in, get some minutes without having to look over their shoulder necessarily as much. They're not going to be doing it in as limited of time as they would be getting if Wagner were available. And it'd be really nice if one of those two guys, or both of them, can be viable rotation players. So we'll see how that goes. But I would say most definitely temper your expectations for non-conference, because Michigan's going to have to find a way to score, and that's really where Wagner was expected to help out a lot. And now you're lacking shooters, and you're lacking creators a little bit. I mean, you're in kind of a tough spot, and there's going to be a lot put on Isaiah Livers. There's going to be a lot put on the Simpson Teske pick and roll combo, and then you just wonder who can make plays off of that. And we're gonna see. We're gonna find out. In a somewhat related question, this is an email from Daniel. Of all the things we could see from this Michigan team early in the season, what's the one thing that, if you see it, you would be the most encouraged by? For me, that would be seeing one of the non-obvious players emerge as a outside shooting threat. I just think Michigan, right now doesn't have much, especially with that three-point line being moved out to the FIBA distance this year, which is upping the degree of difficulty by a couple feet. And so I think if Nunez or Bajema is looking viable early in the season, especially now that Wagner is going to be out for a stretch. I think this question came in before that happened. That to me would raise the ceiling on this team the most, of the things that seem most likely, most reasonably likely to happen. The next question comes from at Lord Razor. Is there a three-point perception that Xavier Simpson should be aiming for this year, or is the hope slash expectation still just that he hits the occasional open look in addition to his other skills? I'll be honest, I personally do not have huge expectations for Simpson's three-point shooting to be much above the 30% that he's been for his career. You know, he's still, even with the improvement that he had last season, not a great free throw shooter, which is usually an indication of your true shooting ability. You get a larger sample size a lot of the time than you do with three-point shots, although not really with Simpson. He's taken more three-pointers in his career than he has free throws by about 20. But, you know, he's a career 60% free throw shooter too, so that's not a great indicator. As I just mentioned, the line moves back, which isn't going to make things easier. And I mean, it's just tough to expect somebody to break out, especially a non-big, somebody who's been shooting throughout their career. It's tough to expect a three-point shooting breakout for them as a senior, when there aren't really peripheral indicators that that's going to be the case. The one hope is that, you know, we have spotted Simpson with a better looking shooting form. At the same time, we also heard that heading into the last season. So we'll see how much he holds on to that, if he reverts at all throughout the season. But I'd mostly be relying on Simpson to be a similar dude that he has been the last couple of years. And those improvements may even come from finding more crafty ways to finish inside the arc, whether it's adding some left-handed finishes, including maybe even a hook shot near the rim, other stuff like that. A floater would be really nice. Simpson does not have as much of an in-between game outside of that hook shot as you would hope. So, you know, it'd be really lovely if he could get up to like 33% to 35%, which would kind of force defenses to at least, you know, think about staying in touch with him out on the perimeter when he doesn't have the ball, and that would open things up if Simpson isn't handling the ball. But I can't say I'm necessarily expecting that to happen. Next one comes from at Tuba1060 on Twitter. You guys joked about using Isaiah Todd as the world's biggest point guard, and less joked about the general potential massiveness of lineups men's basketball could run out in 2020. Do you think playing a jumbo lineup like that is a viable strategy, and what are the potential risks of it? It's viable. I mean, I would like a real point guard to be running that show, but I do certainly think a huge lineup like that is viable. I would say, you know, we mentioned that the Philadelphia 76ers are going to try something like this in the NBA, since they have this 6'10", you know, a unique point guard slash power forward in Ben Simmons, where that really unlocks a lot of unusual lineup combinations, and they've decided to go super big with theirs. You know, there are ways that NBA teams can really pick that apart with shooting and spacing. And I think it's more difficult to do that at the college level just because the skill level is lower. So I think that there are some serious defensive benefits to running out an enormous lineup like that. And then the question is, is what you're gaining in offensive rebounding and ability to score near the basket outweighing what you're probably giving back in terms of overall outside shooting ability? It's tough to not trade off some of that when you're going tall. Although, you know, if we're talking about Isaiah Todd specifically, he does have potential as an outside shooter. Colin Castleton as well. That's looking a year in the future. But even this year's Michigan team could run out some pretty darn big lineups outside of putting Simpson at the point. And that way you can, you know, Michigan may be able to run out some pure zone or matchup zone looks on defense. That can be a nice change up against teams that, especially against teams that aren't great at shooting. Obviously, you get the benefit of kind of the Kentucky style, Carolina style. Just, you can kind of go for turning up the pace of play a bit and just looking to overwhelm teams, basically by playing volleyball on the backboard. I mean, I think most Michigan fans remember having to play against a Kentucky team that featured a serious amount of height in the NCAA tournament, and just how difficult that can be to deal with, even if you have a really high level of skill. The risks are obviously that you don't have enough skill on the court yourself. So you do have to be careful with lineups like that, but if you can pull it off, and with a guy like Isaiah Todd, with a guy like Castleton, even with a guy like, if you got Castleton next to Teske potentially, and Livers at the three, Franz Wagner at the two, and then you still gotta put out Xavier Simpson at the one. But that is an enormous lineup that you can put out there this year. And I think, especially if this team is not going to be great at shooting anyway, there is a lot that can be gained from that, in terms of potentially being able to cover up some perimeter defense issues, as Michigan has a fair amount of turnover there, and loses Charles Matthews, an absolutely elite shutdown perimeter defender. Can increase your rim protection a little bit or a lot. If you got Teske planted in the paint and Castleton coming off the weak side, good luck getting your shots up in the paint. So we'll see. I do think we're going to see Michigan at least toy around with some stuff like this, and I think it could really pay off for them. This next one is a pretty fascinating question, and I liked from at GS Dement on Twitter. On the current roster, who is likely to be better off under Howard versus Beilein, and who is likely to be worse off? I certainly think Brandon Johns stands to benefit a lot from Juwan Howard taking over, in terms of Michigan probably moving to more of a two-post look. And I think, well, he can. He's shown some ability. He showed some ability in high school to stretch the floor a little bit. I think he's more. I've said before, I feel like he's more of a Michigan State power forward than a Michigan power forward in a lot of ways. I expect him to be used more, like Michigan State has used their power forwards in the past under Tom Izzo. Crashing the glass more, being more of a factor inside the arc, not necessarily just standing on the perimeter the whole time. Maybe camping out in that dunker spot a little bit, where you can go for offensive rebounds and get dump offs. You can still use your skill, but it's not necessarily something where you're expecting a guy to be a reliable 3-point threat, although that would be nice. So I think Brandon Johns benefits a fair amount. I think he's the main guy. I also think Colin Castleton benefits too, just in terms of being a big man who's now going to be coached by a former NBA big man. That is certainly not to be overlooked. The guy that I do think is hurt by this is Eli Brooks, who I think stood to benefit from his experience within both the offensive and defensive systems, as a way to gain an edge, both in terms of potentially keeping a starting job over Franz Wagner, if they wanted to use Wagner kind of as a super sixth man, and also for Brooks holding off the likes of David DeJulius at the one, and or potentially the two, and then Adrian Nunez and Cole Bajema. Just for him kind of having to start over with a mostly new coaching staff, that may set him back a little bit. And given that he has been relatively marginal to this point so far in his career, that could certainly hurt him. I think he's the guy who may have been hurt the most by that coaching switch. This next one comes from Hoover Street, our friends Hoover Street Rag. On Twitter, and KenPom preseason rankings are at. What stands out to you? Cough. Purdue. Cough. Yes. The first thing I noticed, and this also jumped out when Bart Torvik released his rankings, is that Purdue sits at number 7 in KenPom's preseason 2020 college basketball rankings. That puts them 2nd in the Big Ten behind number 1 Michigan State. That far less of a surprise when you're looking at rosters. To keep going down the list of Big Ten teams, Ohio State came in at 11th, Maryland at 16th, and then you hit Michigan at 21st. And then the next Big Ten team is actually Indiana at 34th before Illinois at 35th. And then you've got Iowa at 41 and Wisconsin at 45. And that's all the teams that made the top 50. And I'm not going to bother reading from there because the rest of the teams project to kind of stink. Yeah, the thing that definitely stood out to me is Purdue. KenPom projects them to have the number 9 offense in the country, as well as the number 6 defense. I would not be surprised if they have a very, very good defense. They've got a lot of height with Matt Harms blocking shots. Also, Travion Williams is a big dude down there. And I do like them as a 2-post combination on offense. But I do think there is a little bit of awkward post overlap there sometimes. And I just think the loss of Carson Edwards is huge. They do have a grad transfer, Jihad Proctor from High Point, who is a volume scorer type who they're bringing in to hopefully fill Edwards' role. But Edwards was just a special shot maker. He's already had some really impressive efforts for the Boston Celtics in summer league and in preseason, just lighting it up from beyond the arc. So even if Proctor is good for a grad transfer, and he's, shifting up a couple levels going from High Point in terms of conference difficulty, I'm not sure their offense can keep pace. Like, last year they finished 4th, thanks in part to a really strong offensive run in the tournament that was mostly driven by Carson Edwards. I just have a hard time not seeing it drop off a fair amount, even though I do like some of the young players on their team, Aaron Wheeler in particular. But top 10 in the country is a little rich for my taste. I think they're more kind of in that 2nd tier of the Big Ten, maybe even 3rd tier, because I've got Michigan State in a tier of their own, and I might stick Ohio State and Maryland in their own tier as well. I'm going to be putting that post together soon for the site, get those Big Ten tiers rolling out. But I more see Purdue in kind of the Michigan category of, there's certainly potential there, but there's a lot to replace. I think Purdue may project a little bit better. They do bring back a little bit more, but it is a little worrisome that they have to run the offense more through Nojel Eastern, who is just not at all a shooter. And that I think their efficiency is gonna take a hit, and they're gonna have to make it up on defense. So the margin for error closes a bit, and KenPom is also projecting them to make a pretty big defensive leap going from 34th to 6th. So there are a couple things I'm rather skeptical about in there. The defense making that big a leap is one of them, and the offense maintaining their top 10 status is another. So I am pretty skeptical of Purdue, and that was the biggest thing that jumped out to me from KenPom's preseason rankings. All right, this one is in an email from Jeff. The consensus is that big men take time to develop, and Isaiah Todd's only real ding is for not being a physically elite prospect. Between the reports that his motor has started to catch up to his other skills and generally growing up, do you think he's going to be physically ready to play off that talent when he sets foot on campus? Any chance of early enrollment and a summer in Camp Sanderson? I'll say I'm not sure about the early enrollment stuff yet. I haven't seen anything one way or the other on that, but I know that the team with their recruits, at the very least, kind of puts in place a nutrition and workout plan for them that's tailored to them. So I'm sure they will be trying to get Todd bulked up even before he sets foot on campus. And as we've seen with Sanderson, he can get guys in shape relatively quickly. That said, I mean, Todd is probably going to be, a relatively skinny power forward. But he's 6'10". He's really athletic. He's young, and as I said, he got rated really high early based on his potential. That dropped back because of some motor concerns, but he's been playing against some older competition, and things are starting to come together more. So I think he will be physically ready to play off that talent. We might see him, physically ready is in the eye of the beholder in terms of NBA teams are certainly going to look at him and be like, that guy is still a stick and he's going to need to develop to be in the NBA. That could potentially play to Michigan's advantage if he decides to become a two and done, although I guess that would be relatively unlikely, especially since he was looking at overseas options. But I think he's got a chance to be, especially since he won't need to play center. I don't know how much the lack of bulk is going to hurt him, and that athleticism and talent and skill is still going to come through and be pretty impactful. So we could see, I think he could have an impact like Jalen Smith had on Maryland last year, and maybe even a bigger one since potentially it'll be a less awkward fit on the court. Smith had a lot of overlap with Bruno Fernando, and I think Todd is more of a pure four and has a little bit more stretch ability potentially. So we'll see how he fits in. But is he going to be the type of five star one and done that like launches you to a national championship? Not necessarily. Is he one that you can have as a really critical piece to a double bye Big Ten contending top four NCAA tournament seed kind of team? Absolutely. And depending on how the class fills out, and they're certainly aiming high with that, then the ceiling gets raised even higher. And the last question on basketball comes from a Jason B, which means I believe I need to be answering this one. And it hits a subject that I'm glad I'm being asked about too. So it's, do you have any feelings slash predictions about the women's basketball team this year, and what is Kim Barnes-Orico's ceiling at Michigan? KBA has done an awesome job so far in 20 seasons. Michigan has made, or sorry, Kim Barnes-Orico has done an awesome job so far in her tenure at Michigan. She's won 20 games in each of her 7 seasons at the program. And has made the NCAA turn or the NCAA tournament 3 times, and that's definitely an improvement from where the program was standing before. They haven't been able to break through to kind of that upper tier where they can contend for the Big Ten championship quite yet. They've pretty much been a bubble team, and this gets them running into road games against national powerhouses in the NCAA tournament. So that's kind of where the program's been at. And but they're, I do see a chance to take that next step to, I mean, national powerhouse is definitely a few steps away. But contending for the Big Ten, I think, is something that they could do sooner rather than later. While this team does lose a lot, especially at center with Hallie Thome, you've got Naz Hillman, who was a first-team All-Big Ten player as a freshman and the Big Ten Freshman of the Year, despite not starting a game. She led the team in scoring and rebounding. She looks like she's going to be just a really, really, really impressive player. And there's also talent at point guard. Michigan has a former five-star in Amy Dilk there. She started as a freshman. Was relatively productive, was a freshman, does need to be more efficient, but that's something that you would expect from someone going from a freshman to a sophomore. And there's some really interesting talent coming in. There's another top 50-ish prospect in guard, Michelle Sidor. I hope I'm not butchering her last name. And also a potential replacement for Thome at center in Isabel Varejão, who is the niece of Anderson Varejão, who you might remember from the LeBron Cavs teams. She's a 6'4 center. And if she can play immediately, that would very much help this team. So I mean, I expect them to contend for the NCAA tournament again this year, and then going forward, I think the amount of talent that has been amassed, I think this is a team that can hopefully start playing for that second weekend in the tournament instead of being happy to get in there. But it'd be hard to be displeased with the direction that KBA has taken the program, and I think she's raising the talent level and she's raised the performance level. So that's about as much as you can ask for, given what was kind of a difficult job to walk into at a sport that hasn't been hugely emphasized within this athletic department, and now it seems like it's getting some more resources. Obviously, the Chrysler revamp has been helpful to the basketball program. That kind of landed around the same time that KBA came in, and there's also some, you know, some help in kind of having the men's basketball team also be on top. You know, I think basketball programs can kind of piggyback off each other's success. So I think there's reason to be really, really excited about the women's basketball team. And with that, going to take a quick break, come back and talk a little bit of football before interviewing Nick Baumgartner and going much longer on football. So we'll be back after this message.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
Kick off the football section a little differently because we have a public service announcement from reader and listener Joel. I don't think you read podcasts. Who has noticed a thing that Michigan fans are doing in the stadium that is not helping out the kicking game. So I'm going to turn it over to him. While we're on the subject of the kickers, one thing I thought I'd mention is that it doesn't help anyone when our own fans throw the Michigan Kickers footballs out of the stadium when they miss the net. Looking at you, Section 12. I was a football manager back in the 90s, and now, as then, the kickers spend many months working the footballs they're given into perfect shape for kicking. Much like some QBs, kickers like their footballs to be broken in a certain way, inflated a certain way, etc. From spring ball through two-a-days, they spend months getting the 5 to 10 balls Big Johnny gives them into perfect shape, kicking those particular balls every single day. only to have some douche brony in a Michigan floppy hat decide that it's just part of the stadium experience to encourage everyone to toss them out into the concourse. Sometimes the ushers out there are able to grab them before some teenage vendor does and get them back to the sideline, but the team ends up losing as many as they retrieve. Everyone knows what kind of head cases kickers, especially college kickers, are. So anyone who is truly invested in the success of the team, please refrain from doing things that can only hurt and can never help with the team's success. I'm not saying losing all our best kicking balls would directly result in a loss, but Jesus, why are we even risking it? It's bad enough that we lose the good ones in opponent stadiums. Our own stadium needs to be a safe space for our kickers' balls. Joel. P.S. I also just cringe thinking about how Big Johnny absolutely rips into the managers every time a kicking ball goes missing. So yeah, first of all, I think I've got my podcast tagline for this week. Secondly, yeah, don't do that. I can't say I was fully knowledgeable about this and just how few kicking balls that they had worked in starting from the spring and how long they kept those going. I did know that they use special balls for kickers, but don't chuck those out of the stadium. Let's get those back to the sideline, unless they're the other teams, and then chuck away. Let's get a home field advantage going. All right, next one comes from @DanRareEgg on Twitter. What are your feelings on Gattis after PSU and implications for Notre Dame? How much of the solid yardage output was more cohesive play calling versus better execution from Patterson? It's a little bit of a cop-out to say both, I think, but without having gone over the UFR yet, obviously. I think both came into play, and I would say that the increased cohesiveness in the play calling probably helped Shea Patterson have a better day. There were a couple things that stood out as very specific reasons why Patterson had a better day. One goes back to the play calling, which is just picking up easy yards via screens, both in terms of just like, hey, you've got those free easy yards right there. And then also, once the defense adjusts to that, you're able to push the ball downfield more without facing as much defense focused on that part of the field. I do think Patterson executed better. And the other thing that I thought really helped him out was just the protection from the offensive line, which was stellar. And that's been an uptick over recent games. And I don't know exactly what to attribute that to. I don't know if that was play calling. It doesn't seem like it necessarily be related to play calling, because that at least in my eyes, has more affected the running game than the passing game. But, you know, showing the threat to keep, whether that was Patterson or Gattis basically forcing him to with a few design runs, probably helped open things up for the running game. It looks like Jalen Mayfield is getting more comfortable at right tackle, and we'll see. I mean, it's been hard to suss this stuff out all season in terms of, you know, who to attribute credit/blame to. And one game is not a lot to run on. But to my eyes, I think a lot of it was a game plan that made a lot more sense than previous ones. So hopefully that continues, because that has a lot more long-term implications than Shea Patterson being the difference in that game. As for implications for Notre Dame, hopefully they keep throwing those quick hitters. You know, this is a game where they're going to... I mean, every game against good teams, you have to take the easy yards that the opponent gives you. And Michigan has not done a great job of that. Seeing what they did in this game, I have more hope that they'll keep up with Notre Dame, because they at least are taking what's available. So we'll see. I'm trying not to make too much of any one game until we start getting some multi-game sample sizes here, because I've been hurt too many times. All right, this is an email question from Greg. Penn State's offense clearly took advantage of matchups to hit a number of big plays. We've seen this as the way to beat a Don Brown defense if you take advantage of it. Is Michigan's offense trying too hard to establish a base to take advantage of matchups, or are there no good matchups to be had? I'm with you on the chuck it up to our big receivers plan, but is it possible it's not there? I do think they are. Michigan's offense is trying too much to just to run the plays that they kind of probably entered the season wanting to run the offense that they came in envisioning, instead of adjusting to their personnel and just going, hey, we have two or three NFL receivers here, and shoot, maybe in a fourth and Ronnie Bell, who's been more productive than the rest of them, plus some talented tight ends. It's probably time to start going at that. As for the idea that it's not there, we've seen that it's there. We've seen the downfield camera shots on the plays where, you know, former quarterbacks in the booth say that no receivers are open, and they're wrong. And we've also seen that you don't really need these guys to be open for it to work. Nico Collins has, like, not, you know, he's been open a couple times, but most of his catches are contested. But he is 6'4 and can jump and has amazing ball skills. So even when it's not there, it's there. You know, don't throw it when there are like three guys right around him. But if there are three guys right around Nico Collins, there's going to be one around Donovan Peoples-Jones and one around Tariq Black and one around Ronnie Bell. You've got options. So, I mean, yeah, it does really drive home how much Michigan isn't doing what they need to do on offense when you're watching a game like Penn State, where they've clearly identified a matchup that is going to result in big plays and are going at it and going at it repeatedly. And Michigan, meanwhile, is trying to find their identity still, when their identity could absolutely be that we have these receivers and we are a vertical offense. And they have not done that. It kind of confounds that they have not done that. I have a hard time expecting that to change at this point in the season. And to me, it's a significant minus for Gattis that he has not made this adjustment himself, especially if, as we think, the keys have really been turned over to him. All right, next one is from Joe. I feel like Michigan's offensive and defensive systems don't mesh. Aggressive man-to-man defenses are occasionally going to give up big plays, as we have seen. But the offense can't seem to answer except with long, sustained drives. If that is what the offense is going to be, why not make other teams do the same by limiting big plays? I think there's something like Iowa's. I'm thinking something like Iowa's defense. What do you think? Also, I have wondered in the past why Don Brown doesn't use more corners, almost eliminate the safety position. I realize it sounds crazy, but why not just get five great cover guys out there? I don't know, just a thought. Joe. This would be changing pretty much everything that makes Don Brown Don Brown. Iowa's defense is on the complete opposite end of the aggression spectrum. And first of all, we got to go with Don Brown has been phenomenal. Michigan. He really has. I know the Ohio State game from last year leaves a really bad taste in everyone's mouths, but he has shown this year, and we saw it at the very beginning of the Penn State game, that he adjusted to the crossing route stuff. They've started switching those routes. They stopped a Penn State crossing route cold early in that game, and they didn't go back to it. But this is football. Football gives the advantage to the offense, and they're if you're focused on stopping something, you're going to open up something else. We have seen that with the crossing routes and slants versus slot fades, the bind that puts Michigan in. You get the same bind when you're going man versus zone in terms of where you can send pressure, how you can send pressure, how aggressive you can be, where you're tipping the pressure from. Are you tipping your matchups? And so, no, I certainly don't think that going to something like Iowa's defense is the answer, because that is just asking Don Brown to become a completely different person, and Michigan has a better defense than Iowa's. As for replacing safeties with corners, first of all, which corners? Because I'm not seeing them on the roster. and second of all, doing that does sacrifice your ability to stop the run, and that is Don Brown's bread and butter. He is going to stop the run before anything else. So I don't think it particularly makes sense, especially given the composition of this roster. I can see absolutely the argument for sliding LeVert Hill inside to the slot when you're faced with a guy like KJ Hamler, instead of trying to put a safety over him. That said, first of all, the second KJ Hamler TD was a bust, so there was supposed to be a safety over the top of that, which makes the coverage with Josh Metellus make a whole lot more sense. And second of all, you are tipping what you're running when you stick one of your outside cornerbacks in the slot. You're basically saying we are running pure man-to-man. So there's still that there are trade-offs no matter which way you go. I haven't agreed with every trade-off Don Brown has made and every decision he's made in terms of how he has constructed the defense against certain opponents. I'm totally fine with how he's constructed the defense in a big picture sense. And in terms of facing individual opponents, he has made adjustments. I mean, he made adjustments in this game. Michigan had an absolutely killer second half. And was solid in the first half with the exception, largely, I mean, of what they did against KJ Hamler. And again, one of those was a pure bust. Don Brown's really good at this. Let's not lose sight of that fact just because last year's Ohio State game went so disastrously. And especially, you know, I said it on the weekly podcast, the MGO podcast. He is working with a secondary that is probably one or two guys short in terms of impact players of what he'd like. You're especially thin at the cornerback position, but you're also thin at safety. Maybe Dax Hill is the key to unlocking this, since he can run like a corner and play run defense like a safety. But he's got to, you know, download the defense and get used to that, and that can take some time. Don Brown runs a lot of different stuff, and that can take some time to get used to. And as he's added more coverages, as Michigan has needed to adjust the crossing routes and slot fades and all that stuff, it becomes more difficult to pick up the defense as a player in the secondary. We have seen a couple blown coverages as trade-offs for playing more zone. So there's always going to be something that you give up. You can't run a perfectly sound defense. It's just not how football is set up, especially now. It's an offensive game. And I don't have any major disputes with the way Don Brown was running his defense. The last question before we hit up Nick. Earnest question, what's the backstory, if any, behind why Michigan didn't prioritize KJ Hamler? If his 247 page is any indication, it looks like he took several unofficials to Michigan early on, so it certainly doesn't seem like a lack of interest on his part. Thanks, as always, at CJ Dieterle on Twitter. I didn't ping a recruiting guy or anything while doing this, but if memory serves, and I was tracking these relatively closely, this was the year when Michigan brought in the wide receiver class. So and this seemed like a concerted effort from Michigan to recruit a certain type of receiver, where they were going big on the outside with Nico Collins and Tariq Black. They were going just NFL prototype in terms of size and athleticism. You know, you got a 6'2 guy who can play in the slot or the outside in Donovan Peoples-Jones. And then they went for, and I think this was the decision they made, was to prioritize Oliver Martin as the more pure slot type that they took in the class over KJ Hamler. Martin, 6'1", really still a very good athletic profile, very reliable receiver, more of a guy who's going to threaten straight up the field as opposed to a spread jitterbug. So he probably fit in more with Jim Harbaugh's vision of the offense at the time. That said, I thought Hamler was just far too talented to pass up, especially or to not have as a top priority, given what he was doing in high school. I mean, he played at Orchard Lake St. Mary's, so he didn't always get a chance to showcase his stuff in his actual high school games, but they still changed their very option old school offense, you know, straight flex bone stuff. They would still put him out on the field and do some very different things from what you'd see Orchard Lake St. Mary's normally do, just to get the football in his hands. And then also, you know, I was at the Sound Mind, Sound Body camp when he was absolutely unguardable. And that included, you know, obviously receivers have an advantage in those, you know, camp setting, one-on-one type stuff. But he was dusting everybody, and everybody included Ambry Thomas. And we have seen that Ambry Thomas is a good Big Ten corner. And Hamler was unguardable. He caught everything in high school. He catches everything now. You could see the just, you know, make a guy miss in a phone booth ability. Yeah, obviously this one still frustrates me because I think for the most part it came down to height and I think for that reason, height and fit in a more pro style offense as opposed to a spread that Michigan chose to go with Oliver Martin over KJ Hamler, and that obviously has not played out very well for them. All right, that's it for the mailbag. Please stay tuned because on the other side of this break, I will be talking to The Athletic's Nick Baumgartner about the football program.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email jason@blankenshiplawyer.com.
Shapeshifter, thousands in the air, moving as one, magic flocks the reaches, I'm speechless on the ground, black blizzard round a cold gray sun, winter's on the way.
All right, about to start the interview with Nick in a second here. I just wanted to let you all know that I caught Nick while he was in the car. So if there's a little audio weirdness in there, it's because I was trying to run a couple different programs on my end and Nick was in a vehicle. But I think it came out pretty well, and he certainly had a ton of really insightful stuff to say about where the football program's at right now and where it's headed. And the many questions about what's going to happen both for the rest of the season and beyond. So here's my conversation with Nick Baumgartner of The Athletic. All right, we welcome in Nick Baumgartner from The Athletic to help kick off this MCO blog, The Athletic Partnership. How you doing, Nick?
Good, Ace. Is it allowed for a member of the mainstream media to be on one of your podcasts?
I think it's all right. And, you know, they've shunted me off to the side, so I can kind of do this as a workaround. Nick obviously moved over to The Athletic this year. Reuniting with Brendan seems like a positive for the Michigan beat all around. It was weird to have you guys not together for a little while.
Yeah, that was a big part of it, of course. We always had a lot of fun together, worked well together. And he's already sold enough subscriptions, I think, for everyone involved with how good he is. So I keep telling people, look, if you're a Michigan fan, you're not already subscribed just because of him. I'm not sure what you're doing. But, it's been a lot of fun so far, so really enjoying it.
Yeah, there's definitely, I've been subscribed for a while. There is a lot from Michigan fans over on The Athletic.
Mm-hmm.
Getting right into it, I read your post-game piece from Penn State, 3 yards in a mile.
Sure, yeah.
And there was,
kind of getting down to, like, you know, obviously this was a loss and one that featured some ugly moments, but it also kind of looked like it could be a potential turning point in a way. And do you see it potentially being that, or do you think it's still kind of a team that's stuck in a rut?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could be. It depends on, you know, what they want to do. And, you know, because I went back and looked again, and, you know, you saw some bright spots, but you also saw some moments that were just still like, what are you doing? Like, you know, I mean, at the beginning of the game, Shea Patterson's throwing the ball pretty well. He looks like he's in a better spot than he's been. Maybe not perfect, but he looks like he's in a better spot than he's been. And then you get across the 50 and, you know, you decide to punt it. And you do it again in the third quarter. You try a 58-yard field goal. You're doing things from a sideline perspective that are just, you know, sort of very confusing. But yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that they were able to sort of rally together in a really tough spot and get all the way back, I mean, obviously says something about something, because that's even, you know, even after Hamler hits the 53 or 58 yard or whatever it was, you know, it's 28-14 and they'd made some nice strides by then. But when that happened, you're like, okay, well, surely this is just going to fizzle out. And it didn't. So, you know, in some ways, you know, I think you have a chance to gather yourself a little bit. If your offense can kind of build on this. That was the most functional, I think we can all agree, they've been against the quality-ish opponent this year. So it was a weird game, you know. I mean, you know, that it was a weird game. Absolutely. To digest, you know. Like, no one really knew what to think or feel or see about it. And it still sort of feels that way, where it's like, all right, you know, I kind of maybe need to see you do that again against a good team, maybe like Notre Dame this week, before we can buy that as something that's a theme. But it was strange because it was more of the same that we've seen, and then it was some newer things that were probably encouraging, which is why, yeah, I kind of landed on the, you know, sometimes it's, you know, you feel 3 yards away like you were at the end of the game, and then sometimes you still feel like a mile away like you were at various other points in the game where it wasn't so good.
And I saw you posted your film study on focused on Shea Patterson. Obviously, this is a situation where, like, the stat line did not necessarily match up with the perception of his performance. Did those get any closer once you looked at the film, or was this still something where it's like the numbers didn't really tell the whole story?
Yeah, I think a little bit of both. I mean, he wasn't perfect. You know, obviously, I think he still, you know, he missed a shot early in the game. I think the first drop, I guess you'll register to Peoples Jones, was that was a play over the middle where it was kind of a jump ball after Shea had scrambled a bit and the safety punched it out. He missed Donovan open on that play over the middle. And, he got lucky on one to Eubanks over the middle that probably should have been intercepted. And a couple other ones, you know, maybe one or two throughout the game that you went back and you looked and said, okay, those weren't great throws. But for the most part, the pocket presence, feeling the rush, and the clock in his head was pretty good. I mean, it was kind of what I remember when we saw, you know, good Shea Patterson last year, when we saw a guy who handled himself well in the pocket and was able to improvise a little bit. I mean, you know, there's a play, the first completion that he had of the game to Collins, where he kind of moved the pocket to his backside and climbed up and made a nice throw. And then, you know, there was a fourth down play at the end of the game where he's able to evade the rush again, make a throw to keep the game alive, and even the pass to Ronnie Bell that Ronnie Bell couldn't hang on to. You know, that's not, they, you know, for whatever reason, they tried to run a fade there. I don't know if I would have done that, but, you know, Ronnie's not the primary target. You know, there was pressure, the fade was covered, and he had to step up and make a play, and, you know, credit the quarterback for, you know, giving somebody a chance. So I think there was a lot of that. It was a lot of, he really hung in the fight a lot longer and a lot better than we've seen in other games, and I kind of felt like live what, you know, Shea Patterson being like, you know, I don't know what you guys are calling over here, but I'm gonna figure it out on my own. We're gonna do a little bit of improvising at times, and we're gonna figure this thing out. And then sometimes he played pretty well within the offense too, made some nice reads. So I think that had to be encouraging for probably everybody involved, especially Shea. He just seemed much more comfortable with what they were trying to do, whether that was him improvising or whether that was him just following the game plan, whatever it was. So, yeah, the stats didn't tell the whole thing there, I don't think, although it wasn't perfect. But considering what we've seen so far this year, I think that was a pretty healthy step towards something better.
I mean, I think we've been kind of working around towards this question. I think everybody has for most of this year.
But yeah.
Why do you think it's been so difficult for the offense to find any sort of consistent level of success, both within games and over the course of the whole season?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I mean, for me, it's I've kind of questioned the whole year sort of how it was installed. I just don't think that, you know, I keep wondering, what were you doing in camp? Because, you know, when the season started against Middle Tennessee in the first half, they ran a lot of stuff, and it was just like, there's a lot going on here, and, you know, it didn't feel like anything had really been mastered yet, and it felt like they were trying to work in reverse, where they were trying to do a bunch of stuff on and then kind of working out from there. And then, you know, after the Rutgers game, after the Wisconsin game, before the Rutgers game, it seemed like they tried to strip a lot of that down and sort of restart. And no one looked confident in anything they were doing for the first couple weeks. And that, to me, you know, it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, well, you hired a first-time coordinator, and then he looked like a first-time coordinator with his install. So I'm kind of like, I'm not sure what else we should have expected, maybe, in some ways, but... that to me has kind of been my biggest question, because it just never felt like anybody was comfortable. Even some of the offensive linemen and some of the run schemes that, you know, it's like, you know, these guys have proven they can play football. And through the first couple of weeks, there was even some of that. You were just like, that doesn't make a lot of sense. That's not computing with what we saw last year. So it just felt like a lot of, I mean, obviously I understood why they changed it and wanted to make the change. And I agree with that on principle, but it just felt like it probably could have been executed better in the offseason. I think that's about the, I don't know what you guys think. I mean, because that's about the best I can square it, is a missed opportunity maybe to install it.
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me like that's probably one of the most legitimate criticisms, not only of Gattis, but of Jim Harbaugh, yeah. Is that there have been several transitions on the coaching staff under Harbaugh, and they always seem to go rockier than they have to. And it seems like there's a point in the middle of the season when they're kind of backtracking and going, oh, crap, like, we either put too much on, or we didn't drill enough of our base stuff, or whatever it is, it does feel like. And it does feel to me, I don't know if you agree, that a lot of that, because it keeps coming up, comes back to Harbaugh.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, 100%, because it's been like that. Like you said, this is the third coordinator in 4 years, and for the previous ones, it was basically him with guys around him. And it just comes, back to, well, how are you installing this? And I continue to kind of wonder, you know, how are you getting along sort of in terms of communication and everything else with 18 to 22-year-old kids, as opposed to, you know, they're not NFL players. And I know it worked at Stanford, and, you know, Michigan's got a lot of kids on its team that have the same kind of, you know, IQ on the field and off the field as the kids at Stanford did. But it does feel like things are always just a little too complicated, and it feels like there's just too much going on at once. You know, last year at times I thought actually they did a better job of that. I thought they did a better job of simplifying some things and really kind of just relying on what was there, what they did well. And then if there was a criticism, it would have been, you know, the offense just never seemed to enter a game with the understanding of, you know, today we're going to have to go score 35 because we're not beating Ohio State with 21 points, right? That kind of mentality, I guess. But yeah, it's always kind of come back to, you know, how are these things being installed? And we go back and say the best quarterback that he had here was Jake Rudock, who was a medical school student, right? I mean, not to say the other guys aren't smart football players and smart kids, because they've all been that, even the backups. But you know, you had a really high IQ guy who really clicked with you, and from there it was a lot of younger players who were still trying to develop their game, so to speak. Even Shea Patterson was only a second-year player when he got here. So that's been kind of my question. It's just like, you know, how are you – it seems like Harbaugh does very well with the fifth-year and the older guys who've been around a long time. But it's like these younger guys sometimes, boy, it just seems like a lot of them are swimming, you know, maybe more than they need to be, and that seems to be repeating itself.
So, I mean, you've been around the program for – a decent amount of time at this point. Mm-hmm. You've seen them through some tougher times than this, and also
for sure.
These times. But do you have a sense of how, like, the athletic department powers kind of feel about the program compared to, like, the fan base at large? Because it does seem like there's probably a pretty big gap there.
Yeah, I think so. I think that when Ward Manuel says repeatedly that he wants Harbaugh to be his head coach for as long as possible, I think that that's real. I think that's genuine. I think that they see the stadium for the most part, you know, it's still full, you know, it's until something like that were to change. And I think they see the fact that, you know, they're in a better spot in terms of program health than they were when Brady Hoke's time was done. I think no one can objectively say otherwise to that. And so they look at all those factors and say, you know, they're in a position now where it's like, you got to find a way to get yourself from good to great. So that's the hardest part. And getting from six wins to nine is difficult, but getting from 9 to 10, you know, 9 and 10 to 11 and 12 is really the hardest thing that anybody can do. And just starting over constantly like that, you know, that would have been, you know, if you do it again this year, you know, that's four coaches since 2008. That's a lot. And, you know, you're one or two, maybe one more, you're one mistake away from like flirting with Tennessee land, you know, I mean that. And I think that the people upstairs know that, and they want to keep it as stable as they can. I think that they trust him. But at the same time, you know, I think that it's fair to, you know, it's fair if some folks in those situations also want to maybe take a deeper look at and say, how are we doing things here? You know, are we doing things that you know, the way that they need to be done to get us over that next hump, or are we just kind of stuck in our ways here? So, you know, I do think there's a disconnect from the section of the fan base that's, you know, next, you know, because that section of the fan base has been saying that since 2017. I mean, for being honest, sure, here, they've been saying that for 2 years. So, you know, that's every time they lose a game or somebody throws in a complete pass, that type of crowd has been to get this guy out of here. So I think that the stuff up top, for the most part, until as we talk today, I mean, it's been pretty genuine on their approach that sort of staying the course in a larger sense makes more sense for the program.
And kind of jumping off of that, you know, Michigan's got this offensive coordinator in his first year who has not done great so far. At the same time, we've seen them struggle every time they flip over offensive coordinators. What does Gattis have to do the rest of this year to kind of show that it's a good enough idea to continue going forward with him to make it,
yeah,
to kind of overcome those transition costs that you get replacing him?
Man, that's a great question, because it's so hard. Because it's like, I mean, I feel like the easy answer is to say that there can't be any more steps in the wrong direction. Like, there can't be any more, you know, Iowa games, you know, kind of things where,
sure,
you're just like, what are you doing? It all has to sort of continue to, and I think, to be fair, you know, they were better offensively against a bad Illinois team, and they were certainly better offensively against Penn State. So that's back-to-back weeks now where you can say, you know, that's better. And I think that if that continues and you continue to see better play and more logical, you know, approaches to a game plan week to week, and guys that are more comfortable with their role and understanding of what they're trying to do, if you see that every week, then I think you can square that. But if we go through the next five games and we're looking at it and saying, well, you know, they had a terrible day again against, you know, like Maryland or something, or Michigan State bothers them to a point that was more than necessary, or you go to Ohio State, you can't score anything, even though Ohio State's good. I mean, if it continues to look a little, go back to those days where it looked a little hapless, then it's time to wonder, do you just move on from this, or do you wait it out, or do you tweak his role maybe somehow? I don't know. Maybe I don't know what that would look like either, because you're paying him so much money. But I would think that it would have to be continued progress, because, you know, the whole idea of time on task, I only go so far with that. I mean, it's obviously something that needs to happen. And I looked at it at the beginning of the year and said, I kind of just arbitrarily picked that Iowa game before the year started and said, well, I would understand some struggles all the way through there. And then beyond that, I would kind of think, you know, it needs to start picking up, because that's probably far enough along reasonably to ask people to, we had all of fall camp, you had all of that, those games in the season. So from there, it needs to really start to go in the right direction only. And so no more steps backward, which is tough to do, of course. But, you know, that's a really, really good question, because I really don't know. You know, and you wonder, you know, how much is he learning? How much is he changing? And I guess we'll see that. We'll see if he truly is learning and changing from his mistakes as he goes forward, too, because it's brand new for him as well.
And that's obviously going to be relatively difficult given the closing schedule. So what is I promise this is the last question. What's kind of your outlook as Michigan moves towards the end of its schedule now? I mean, PSU may have somehow changed that for the positive, I guess. We'll see.
Good. Well, I think Saturday against Notre Dame is a big one, because that's the game I mean, not to say that you should win this game or necessarily because Notre Dame's a good team, but that, you know, these home games have typically been games Harbaugh's won. I mean, they've played well at home. They've been tough to beat at home. Even when they haven't been good, they've been tough to beat at home. So that's one that I'd point to and say that, you know, if you get a win there, that maybe changes my outlook a little bit. I don't think it would be enough to say that, you know, I think they would be able to beat Ohio State, but if you were able to beat Notre Dame, I think that would make me think, you know, that's probably a 9-3 team. If you lose that one and you don't look very good, then I start to wonder, you know, how this is really going to look. Is 8 or 7 even possible? I think 7-9 seems to be the range, and maybe you split the difference and say it's 8. That's kind of where I've landed on it right now, and obviously that's not going to be good enough for anybody. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to see anything beyond that right now. I mean, 9 would be I think 9 would actually be kind of impressive. You know,
at this point,
it's like, yeah, I mean, it's like if you got to 9, I think they'd be like, hell, that's a pretty good, back half of the season coaching job to get that thing turned around. So, I mean, 8 probably looks like the logical choice right now, 9 being impressive and 7 not being impossible.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like we're headed for another offseason of a certain level of unrest unless there's a pretty big upset sprung in there.
Right, for sure.
Before I let you go, anything you'd like to plug, Nick?
Just get a subscription, man. Theathletic.com. They've got deals all the time. Like I said, if you're not reading already for Brendan, I don't know what you're doing. But I mean, like, we've got myself and Austin Meek. We do our podcast twice a week, and we have content every week, too. So, appreciate the support from you guys as well. And, just subscribe and support content. I think that we can all agree for that, right? I mean, I know you guys have folks have an opportunity to do that too with the stuff you guys do too. So it's okay to support stuff you like. I think that's the message I would send to most everybody.
It's been very cool to see The Athletic grow the way it has, and the Michigan content on there is highly recommended. It is fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you for joining us, Nick, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again at some point.
Absolutely. Anytime, Ace. Thank you.
All right. We really appreciate, once again, Nick Baumgartner coming on to chat with us for a little bit. That was certainly an interesting discussion, mostly centered on the offense and the direction of the program. Nick's obviously been around to see a lot of this, and he does excellent work both with his columns and his film breakdown. Like I said, if you haven't checked out the Michigan stuff over at The Athletic, it is well worth your time and absolutely your money as well, especially since you get an ad-free experience, and it is just a few bucks a month, especially when you catch one of their many promotions. So you are strongly encouraged to check that out. And with that, that is all for this week. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship for sponsoring the podcast. And I will catch you all next week.